Foundations for Prophecy, Commentary for the May 17, 2025 Sabbath School Lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com. I warn everyone who hears the words of the prophecy of this scroll. If anyone adds anything to them, God will add to that person the plagues described in this scroll. And if anyone takes words away from this scroll of prophecy, God will take away from that person any share in the tree of life and in the holy city, which are described in this scroll. Revelation 22, verses 18 and 19. Our Sabbath School Lesson Quarterly goes a little off the rails this week. While it claims to be setting a proper foundation for prophecy, it does so by asserting that two cherubim were guarding the gate to Eden after humanity was expelled. There is no biblical basis, and none in Patriarchs and Prophets by Ellen White, for this assertion of exactly two cherubim. While it is true that words ending in im in Hebrew are plural, as in cherubim, that ending does not specify two, but simply more than one. I do not know if the lesson author or the editor was responsible for this slip-up, but no source for there being two cherubim is cited, other than to claim a dubious link between the two cherubim over the Ark of the Covenant and those guarding Eden. Sometimes, if we do not know, we should humbly admit it, instead of concocting ideas that then call for ever more strained defenses to shore up the rickety structure we are insisting is truth, as opposed to sticking to the script God has preserved. Another troubling slip is the assertion that the faces on the four-faced cherubim in Ezekiel and Revelation are the symbols on the standards of the leading tribes on the four sides of the wilderness tabernacle. The authors of a 2011 commentary are cited as a source, but that commentary claims it is based on rabbinic tradition without any citing of the Talmud or Midrashim to back up that claim. What passes for scholarship in our Sabbath School Quarterly has seriously gone downhill. It is little wonder that in parts of Europe they prefer to publish their own lesson quarterly. For those who might feel this is unimportant, if John could write such strong words about those who add to or remove words from Revelation, how much more so does it apply to those who rewrite Torah? A proper foundation for understanding prophecies is to stop building tenuous structures based on suppositions or maybes, or at least admit that is what they are before someone leans too heavily against the walls of our house of straw and collapses everything. Our denomination is already facing this over the idea of an investigative judgment beginning in 1844. This is based on a supposed vision by Hiram Edson while walking through a cornfield the day after the great disappointment of October 1844. Despite Edson never claiming it was a vision and never writing an article for the review about it, even though he wrote other articles on other topics, a mythology is built up about the event that served the purposes of a discredited denomination that had become a laughingstock to their friends and neighbors. It allowed the little flock to say, "See, we were right all along. We just had the event mixed up." Conveniently, since the event has been switched to heavenly places, not visible to human eyes, humanity cannot gainsay what did or did not take place in 1844. What is known, however, is that despite the vision supposed to have taken place the very next day, that little flock of pre-Seventh-day Adventist believers did not accept it for several years, continuing to believe that probation had shut the door on those who did not believe that anything significant happened in 1844. To a degree, that thinking persists, as ministers have been defrocked for questioning the circumstances that gave rise to the investigative judgment doctrine. Even today, only those not in denominational employment are able to question it without financial repercussions. As was related to me by a ministerial secretary who oversaw the pastoral staff for one of our larger conferences several years ago, the church uses money to control freedom of thought, firing those who step out of line. The Seventh-day Adventist Church considers itself the remnant of Revelation chapter 12, keeping the commandments of God and having the testimony of Jesus, according to verse 17. A remnant is defined by various dictionaries as all that remains of something. If that is the case, then the denomination claims to be all that remains of God's people. However, most Adventists believe that God saves people outside of Adventism, which is a schizophrenic theology, for how can the remnant be defined as the denomination defines it without believing that the definition of what constitutes a remnant would mean that all true believers will eventually become Seventh-day Adventists until there are none of God's people outside that narrow definition? As unlikely as this seems, it becomes even more so when we consider the second part of the qualifications for being the remnant. The denomination defines the testimony of Jesus according to Revelation chapter 19, verse 10, where the testimony of Jesus is called the spirit of prophecy. This epithet, spirit of prophecy, is widely used as a euphemism for referring to Ellen White, whom the denomination holds to have been a prophetess of God. Whether one agrees with that determination is not the point, for absent a purge of membership, there are many who struggle with that who are nonetheless on the church books. The point that needs to be understood here is that defining the second characteristic in this way means that no matter where someone does or does not fellowship, accepting Ellen White as divinely inspired is an essential qualification to be in the remnant as defined by Adventism. The arbitrariness of this definition is an indictment of proof texting our way to salvation. While this has become an ironclad determinant for many within the denomination as to who is and who is not Adventist, the phrase testimony of Jesus could just as easily be referring to all the recorded teachings and the life lived by Jesus, something of which John the Revelator was well aware. John, brother of James, had gone from being considered one of the sons of thunder in Mark 3:17 to calling himself in his gospel the disciple whom Jesus loved, as in John 19, verse 26. In his epistles, John wrote extensively about love and its role in our relationship to God and the rest of humanity. He came to understand the love of God more than any other disciple. This may have been why Martin Luther had difficulty accepting revelation as legitimate, as it was harder to see love with all the imagery of destruction and judgment. As a denomination, we have lost sight of the very things about Jesus that filled John's heart with love for his teacher. Christianity and Adventism is not an exception to this, despite their remnant claims, has devolved into a fortress mentality, and like Horatio at the bridge, is determined to hold out against the enemy to the death if necessary. When I think of the sheep who've been driven from fellowship due to this mentality in my lifetime, it breaks my heart. If the commandments of God resemble even remotely Jesus' teaching about loving God and loving our neighbor, and if the testimony of Jesus is to be loving, then we have gone seriously astray. In so many churches, and not just Adventist churches, the church members cannot even consider the people who live right next door to the church as friends to be loved. Instead, we drive many miles from other neighborhoods to worship in neighborhoods where we know no one. And once we have performed our weekly worship, we bundle ourselves back into our vehicles and drive back to our neighborhoods, leaving the residents around the church to wonder why our church is even there in their neighborhood. This remote migration has the added, but sad, benefits that no one around the church has any idea what the lives are like of those commuting into the parish, and no one where we live has any idea what we do when we leave weekly for that far-off church. All the better to avoid accountability for the faith we profess. I cannot help but wonder if we eschewed all the creeds we created to keep people out and instead just loved one another, what would ensue? It is fear of the other that keeps that from happening. There are so many that are using fear to manipulate others politically, religiously, and corporately. It can be hard to see the invisible chains they are forging for us through appealing to our fears. And when we succumb to those fears, we become willing participants in forging those chains for others as we recruit them to our fears. It is long past the time when we should replace our fears with the love Jesus taught. When we do, we will discover that fear and love cannot dwell together, and love is a better choice. As the Apostle Paul wrote, "And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love." 1 Corinthians 13:13. Thank you for listening to this commentary podcast. You can find the written version of this podcast, as well as hundreds more commentaries and podcasts, at our website at www.visitstillwaters.com. You can also find links to other articles and books written by the author. Once again, that's www.visitstillwaters.com. May God richly bless you and your family.